The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
A respiratory virus has millions of people on lockdown in China, but the global health community is still trying to understand and control this new strain of virus. We have the latest. I'm Marco Werman. Also today, diplomats who've worked in Russia and Ukraine say they want U.S. policy to send a strong message.
Russia, get out of Ukraine's backyard. Move your military forces out. Move your equipment out. Move your proxies out.
And we hear from one Iowan what the caucuses are really like.
Everybody is crammed in and there's all kinds of things going on, and that you're sitting in that dunk tank and somebody dumps you in the cold water.
And from the animal world, the emotional lives of cows. Bovines and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It started in China, and the virus and the story have now gone global. The coronavirus outbreak has now infected nearly 8,000 people in China. At least 170 have died. And now more than a dozen countries have identified cases of the virus. The World Health Organization's Emergency Committee met again today to work on next steps. The World's Ilana Gordon is with me in the studio and has the latest. So last week this committee met. They met again today. They were trying to figure out whether to declare this situation a public health emergency of international concern. What happened today?
Well, they did it. They did declare it, yes, a public health emergency of international concern. They said it was a long day and actually a very long week. But here's the director of the WHO, Dr. Tedros, on why they reached that decision today.
Our greatest concern is the potential for the virus to spread to countries with weaker health systems and which are ill prepared to deal with it.
So, Ilana, what does that mean exactly? What are the implications of a public health emergency of international concern?
Absolutely. So Dr. Tedros, as we just heard, stressed that China is actually setting a new standard. He lauded what they're doing. He said this international emergency, it's not about being like a vote of no confidence in the country. What he basically says is that for countries that might be weak or have weak health systems, the big concern is if something like this type of virus spreads there, they want to be prepared. So a public health emergency of international concern, it's a very specific designation. It's only been declared 5 times before. And really what it is about is something that's a, quote, extraordinary event. Last week, the WHO kind of went back and forth because they weren't sure if this was an emergency outside of China. The disease hasn't been spreading too much out of China, but at the same time, they want to be ready. A declaration, what it does, it allows the WHO to really garner the public health community, the global community, encourage more funding, public health efforts, and also be more firm in recommendations. So, for example, what Dr. Tedros also said today is that he's not encouraging places to limit movement or trade.
So what do you think changed their thinking?
A lot hinges on what they know and what they don't know. So when you think about a disease like this, they're still trying to figure out how easily it can spread, how contagious it is, and also how fatal it is. And these are still things they're trying to better understand. But again, what they're saying now is between last week and now, there have been a lot more cases in China, as we heard, about 7,700 plus 170 deaths.
Right.
The deaths have only been in China. And then in other countries, there have been so far 98 cases in 18 countries. And actually today, there was a development in the United States. There was a 6th case. And what's interesting is that that came from somebody who actually hadn't been to China. It was the spouse of somebody who had been to China.
Gotcha. Now, you spoke with somebody from the CDC. What are we hearing from the CDC?
Well, the CDC held a presser earlier to go over exactly what the situation was. They said that this couple, they're both in stable condition. And essentially, Nancy Messonnier with the CDC, she said they're basically trying to kind of wrestle and balance being really aggressive to prevent the spread of something like this in the community, which is not happening, but also not to overreact.
While it is cold and flu season, we don't routinely recommend the use of face masks by the public to prevent respiratory illness, and we certainly are not recommending that at this time for this new virus.
So we'll see if that protocol holds as the virus continues to spread, Ilana. Do we know how this virus might compare to other diseases and things like SARS?
Again, the signs of this kind of virus, it's coughing, fever, but researchers caution against making any sort of comparisons. And actually, to know more, we're going to bring in tomorrow on the show Michael Minna, who is an expert of infectious disease at Harvard School of Global Health, to get more into these questions.
The World's Ilana Gordon, thanks very much.
Thank you.
No matter what happens next with this coronavirus outbreak, scientists are working on developing a vaccine for it. That won't happen overnight. The pharmaceutical company Inovio is one of a number of research facilities urgently trying to develop a vaccine. The BBC's global health correspondent Tulip Mazumder reports from the company's labs in San Diego.
We're in the manufacturing lab where there are a number of glass fermenters and beakers with this dark brown liquid bubbling away inside, letting off a very musty smell, I must say. It's in these beakers that the key ingredient of this possible vaccine for the new coronavirus is being made up. Joining me to tell us a little bit more about the process is the head of research and development here at Inovio, Dr. Kate Broderick. Dr. Broderick, just start by telling us a bit more about this vaccine.
So the virus was first identified on the 31st of December. Then approximately a week later, the Chinese authorities published the sequence of the virus. Immediately, we started working on designing the vaccines. And actually, within 3 hours, we'd come up with a fully designed DNA medicine against the coronavirus.
That's extremely quick, isn't it?
It's really unprecedented.
And how does this vaccine work?
Yeah, so this vaccine is based on DNA medicine technology. And although I'm sure you're all familiar with traditional vaccines, DNA medicine is a little bit different because we use genetic sequences. And in this case, we use the genetic sequence of the virus itself. We put that small piece of the virus genetic sequence into DNA. We grow it up in bacteria, and that's what you can smell here in this lab today. Then we purify the medicine from the bacteria, and we use that for testing. That'll be both preclinical and clinical testing.
I remember reporting on the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, and at the start of that, I mean, you know, people didn't have anything. There was no vaccine, no cure. The development of that vaccine had taken, you know, decades. We've known about this virus for a very long time. What's changed? How is it possible that you're able to come up with at least the design of a vaccine pretty much overnight?
I think what's really changed is the whole international response to viral outbreaks, and particularly the formation of CEPI.
And when you talk about CEPI, you're referring to this International Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness.
Innovation, exactly, that was formed in Davos 3 years ago, really, and its whole mission is to support the proactive generation of vaccines for outbreaks before they actually occur.
From everything you're seeing unfolding in China, and now in several other countries as well, how concerned are you about what's happening?
I am concerned as a scientist. I didn't expect the virus to spread as fast as it has. What also is particularly concerning to me is the incubation period, the time from when you're infected with the virus to the time that you start showing symptoms. Some people are estimating that that's as long as 14 days. And when you consider you could be walking around feeling perfectly well, but spreading this virus to everyone you meet, that's exceedingly concerning when you're trying to control an outbreak.
Do you think you can get this vaccine out in time to help people in this outbreak in China?
We are hoping to get this vaccine into human clinical testing by early summer, which is unprecedented in itself. And we hope that as we expand that clinical testing, we'd be able to get it to the people who really need it.
Dr. Broderick, thank you for your time. Well, no one knows how long this outbreak will go on for and whether a vaccine will be available to help people, mainly in China, in time. But scientists here and in many similar research facilities all around the world are racing to get one into communities as soon as possible.
BBC Global Health correspondent Tulip Mazumder reporting from a pharmaceutical lab in San Diego where scientists are working on a vaccine. Stay with The World for ongoing coverage of the coronavirus outbreak. We're on day 9 of the impeachment trial of Donald Trump. Senators are spending a second and final day of putting questions to both sides. The president's defense team now seems focused on the argument that even if the president did what Democrats allege, it is not impeachable. One of Trump's lawyers, Alan Dershowitz, took that argument to a new level yesterday. He said any actions taken by a president to get reelected could even be in the public interest. Chuck Schumer, the top Democrat in the Senate, responded to that this morning.
The Dershowitz argument, frankly, would unleash a monster. More aptly, it would unleash a monarch. Think about this. According to Dershowitz, impeachment is only for criminal offenses. Meanwhile, President Trump's Justice Department argues that a sitting president can't be indicted, can't indict for criminal conduct, can't impeach for non-criminal conduct. The president could blackmail a foreign country into poisoning our elections and get away with murder, literally, so long as he's in office. If Senate Republicans vote to endorse these ideas by shutting down a fair trial, they could spell the end of presidential accountability as we know it.
Trump's legal team disagrees. They say American voters provide the ultimate form of accountability. Republicans are also warning against starting an era of impeachment that threatens to undermine the electoral process. Garrett Graff with Wired joins me now. Garrett, what do you make of the arguments from both sides about what's at stake in this trial beyond just the future of Donald Trump?
This is very much becoming a fight about something much larger than just Donald Trump. I mean, it is about a very different view of presidential power. This argument in the last 24 hours from the president's lawyers, it certainly harkens back to Richard Nixon's, if the president does it, it's not illegal. But it also reminds me a lot of President Trump on that Access Hollywood tape. If you're a star, they let you do it and you can do anything, is what he argued back then.
So what's been happening today? What are you seeing?
Well, what I think you're seeing is both sides, Democrats and Republicans, playing to the House managers and to the president's counsel, giving them a chance to continue to sort of air their arguments and try to pick away at the other side's arguments. There's not a lot of great rhetorical debate or Perry Mason-like questioning that's taking place today. This is, sort of two people sparring through questions.
And what are the latest betting odds on whether the Senate will indeed call former National Security Advisor John Bolton as a witness?
Well, remember, it was just 2 days ago where Mitch McConnell told the Senate caucus that he did not think that he had the votes to block witnesses. This comes after John Bolton's sort of stunning revelations that he thinks that he has evidence that could back up the House impeachment case. That seemed a premature decision or a premature announcement by McConnell on Tuesday, probably aimed actually at driving Republican unity. And indeed, as of today, you're beginning to hear the Republicans say that they do think that they have their votes to block the witnesses, and in which case, in some manner, this trial may be over tomorrow.
That'd be extraordinary. I mean, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said today if Trump is acquitted with no witnesses, then it's not a genuine acquittal. Senator Amy Klobuchar said it would not be a fair trial. Democratic Representative Gerald Nadler said the House might just subpoena John Bolton anyway. What are your thoughts?
Well, this is clearly not going to be over if an acquittal comes tomorrow. You know, the House can continue their investigations. They could actually send further articles of impeachment over the course of the year for this or other politically impeachable crimes that the president may have committed. And, you know, this is a president who has made clear that, you know, getting away with something actually does not chasten his future behavior, but in fact exacerbates it. So, you know, if the president is acquitted, it does not seem like the president is likely going to be chastened in any way by this slap on the wrist of impeachment.
Garrett, one final thing. Help us understand why the witness question is kind of framed by Republicans as a trade-off, John Bolton in exchange for the Bidens, because Republicans have a majority in the Senate, right? If they want to hear from the Bidens, can't they just call them?
Yeah, I think they're trying to use calling the Bidens as the nuclear option. Calling witnesses, admitting more evidence is supported by an overwhelming majority of the American people. I mean, polls are consistently showing about 70% of the American people think that witnesses should be called. You probably can't get 70% of America to agree that the Super Bowl is next weekend at this point in America.
We're going to have to leave it there, Garrett. Garrett Graff of Wired Magazine, thanks very much for updating us. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We reported the other day on migrants trying to travel through Mexico en route to the U.S., stopped south of the Mexican border with Guatemala. Police would not let them enter. There are migrants from Central America, though, who have entered Mexico, and thousands have been put in detention centers. Now Mexican officials have closed access to those detention centers for human rights groups. It appears likely that humanitarian workers will be allowed back into these detention centers, but this temporary ban has led to worries about human rights violations. The World's Jorge Valencia is here in the studio to explain. Jorge, what do we know about why the Mexican government decided to stop allowing NGOs from entering these detention facilities?
The Mexican government has detention centers for migrants all over the country, and the biggest one is the one that is closest to the border with Guatemala. So what the Mexican government is saying is that in the past 2 weeks, when they had this influx of somewhere around 4,000 people showing up almost at once at the border, they took a lot of these people and they have a crush of people in their facilities, and that it will be easier for them to process these people if there aren't outside people at the facilities. So that is what they're saying. And that has caused a lot of confusion because Mexico's migration authorities have said this in a statement this week, that they stopped allowing humanitarian workers into their facilities. And meanwhile, there have been competing statements from the agency that runs their migration office saying that they have no idea what they're talking about. So there's an explanation from the Mexican government, but there's also a lot of confusion.
And the humanitarian workers who are affected by this, what do they have to say?
Well, you won't be surprised to hear that they are quite alarmed by this, because what they do for the most part is give information to the people who are being held there. Just tell them really basic things like you have a right to petition for asylum in Mexico if you desire to do so. Just really basic things like that. And they also observe the situation.
Right.
Salva La Cruz is from the Fray Matias Human Rights Center in the city of Tapachula, just next to the border with Guatemala.
La población está hacinada. Frecuentemente se supera el cupo máximo de la capacidad de ingreso que tiene ese centro, que es aproximadamente de...
So what he's saying is that he's describing what it often looks like when he has been at this facility, which is severe overcrowding. This is a facility that holds about 1,000 people. And many times last year when he and his colleagues visited, it was a facility that was holding more than 2,000 people.
Yeah, not to mention some of the unhygienic conditions that we've been hearing about. Do these humanitarian workers you've spoken with, Jorge, do they have a theory as to why they more or less got kicked out of these detention centers?
So I spoke to several people about this, and Gretchen Kuhner with the Institute for Women and Migration in Mexico City, she has a theory about this.
They're using detention centers now that are warehouses that don't have all of the proper facilities, and they don't have computers and all of the things that people need in order to keep track of what's happening. So my sense is that they didn't want any monitoring while they were fast-tracking deportations of people who had been participating in the caravans.
And there are numbers from the Mexican government that substantiate this explanation for it. They received somewhere about 4,000 people in the past 2 weeks, and they very quickly started deporting people. And according to the Mexican government, they've deported upwards of 2,000 people. So more than half the people who crossed the border have already been returned to other countries.
So what does the Mexican government say about when they'll begin to allow independent observers back into these detention centers?
So there was pushback as soon as the government announced this, and in response, the Mexican government has said, starting on February 1st, we will begin allowing people to enter again. The thing is that some of these humanitarian workers have been denied access without there being a public statement the way that there was this past week. So there's still a lot of skepticism and a lot of anxiety about whether or not they'll be able to return to provide these services.
The World's Jorge Valencia, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Tomorrow, we'll be hearing about the U.S. immigration detention system, which some presidential candidates are proposing to shut down. We first told you about 26-year-old Naama Issachar back in November. She's an American-Israeli woman who was arrested in Moscow on drug charges back in April and was sentenced to 7.5 years behind bars.
She's not good. She tries to be as optimistic as possible and to, you know, to remain hopeful, but... You know, I could see it in her eyes and in her energy that she's tired. You know, she's languishing in a prison.
That's Naama's sister, Liad Goldberg, speaking with us last fall. At that point, Naama had already spent months in a Moscow jail. She'd been arrested in Moscow during a layover. Her family maintains the drug charges were just an excuse to set up a possible prisoner swap that entangled Russia, the U.S., and Israel. That diplomatic nightmare for Naama and her family ended today with her release from prison. She flew out of Moscow on board Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's plane. I'm still shocked by this entire situation, she said as she landed in Israel. Naama's sister, Liad Goldberg, joins us again now from their family home in Rehovot. So you've seen your sister in person, finally. What was that reunion like, and how does she seem?
It was so crazy, honestly, because it's... you know, it's a moment that I feel like I've been dreaming about for so many months now. And today was so crazy and hectic leading up to the time that she landed that I almost felt like by the time she landed, I had like no energy. And then even when we got to the airport, I didn't know when I was going to see her, how, which way, you know, it was really at the very last minute. Some of the airport people were like, she's right here.
I mean, it all started this morning in Moscow, right? And she flew out this morning and now it's a whole day of this. Your sister's legal team said that this is the first time Russian President Vladimir Putin has granted a pardon to a foreign national. What did it take to get her released? Who was involved?
Wow. So many. You know, we started this campaign. It started out really small. It started as, you know, a small Facebook group. And it just grew. I have to say, I'm so proud of the campaign. It was completely self-funded, of course, with donations. People worked pro bono.
And where do Prime Minister Netanyahu and Russian President Vladimir Putin fit into how Naama got released?
Well, you know, she was locked up in Russia, and we just pleaded with him, like, help us. If anyone can help us, it's you. Because you're the prime minister of this country and he has good relations with Putin. I'm not going to lie. It took some time to really get him involved and invested. It wasn't an overnight thing. We really, really pushed. And my family's relentless. We're stubborn and we're relentless. And for the first time, it got put to good use. I'm just happy she's home.
So I know she's been through a lot, but I know Naama is with you, at home with you now. Is there any chance we could say hello?
She's not speaking right now to the press. She's very shaken up. She needs her time to kind of decompress, and she doesn't really fully understand what's going on. So unfortunately, at this time, she's not giving any statements.
I totally understand. Can I just ask you what you two had to break bread tonight? What did she really want?
My dad's a chef, so while we were bringing her home from the airport, he was home cooking, and he cooked his veggie patties, kube. We had wine, you know, just our fridge is stocked for her, for sure.
Leah Goldberg, the sister of American-Israeli Naama Isahar, who was released today from a prison in Moscow. It's good to speak with you again, Leah. Certainly under different circumstances, you sound much happier than the last time.
I'm so much happier. I'm so happy that we got our girl back and we can just go on to resume our normal, mundane life, really.
Thank you. All the best.
Thank you.
News headlines are next. You're with the world. Iowa is proud of its presidential caucus, but it's not easy for everyone to participate.
There's been discussion about whether or not we should encourage non-English speakers to attend the caucus because it might be a really negative experience and they may never vote again.
That's coming up next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. It is actually happening more than 3.5 years after British voters decided to leave the European Union. Brexit is finally going down tomorrow night. Supporters of Brexit will be celebrating in front of Parliament, but for one of the largest immigrant communities in the UK, there is less to celebrate. More than 800,000 people living in Britain were born in Poland. From London, here's The World's Orla Barry.
Ever since Poland joined the EU in 2004, Poles have been moving here to live and work in big numbers. After India, people born in Poland are the largest immigrant group in Britain. And in recent years, Polish was the second most common language in the UK. That's why in 2016, when the Brexit vote passed, the Polish community felt particularly targeted. I've come to a little cafe in South London to meet Anna Oppenheim.
You're not Anna, are you?
I am Anna.
Anna was 18 when she arrived here from Warsaw 8 years ago. She came to study fashion at Central St Martin's, a prestigious art school. But London felt very different in those days, she says.
You know, when I came in 2012, it was during the Olympic ceremony when everyone was talking about diversity and multiculturalism, and especially being in London in an art school, it felt very friendly.
Anna says it didn't take long to notice that British attitudes towards foreign workers, like her, were changing.
around 2013-14 was when I started realizing how much this country loves talking about us, how it was usually, you know, white English men on the news talking about migrants in terms of numbers, in terms of floods, in terms of stealing jobs and taking over the NHS and so on. And that's when I started realizing there's quite a lot of hostility.
She was devastated by the result of the Brexit vote, and it changed the way she views Britain.
It definitely collapsed the idea I had in my head about Britain being this open, welcoming country. It did show me just how many people there were who didn't want people like me in the country. And, you know, one of the reasons I left Poland in the first place was the kind of extreme social conservatism that made living there quite hostile. And suddenly I felt like, well, neither of my countries really wants me.
The 2016 Brexit vote also took Barbara Moskal by surprise.
It was a big shock. At the very beginning, I didn't even think how it can affect my life, my work, how I became some sort of a chip in a game.
Like Anna, Barbara moved to Britain as a student. After university, she decided to stay and work. Before the Brexit referendum, Barbara worked for a small company involved in imports and exports within Europe. After the result, the value of the British pound dropped, and Barbara's boss was forced to let workers go, including her. She says she's not bitter, though, especially because of the severance package she got after being laid off.
Because I understand what choices he had to do. To be honest, I have received a generous redundancy package, so this did not leave me with any hard feelings to that person.
Barbara landed on her feet, but not here in the UK. I meet her in the stylish offices where she now works as a business analyst in Krakow. After losing her London job, Barbara uploaded her CV onto recruitment sites. Within hours, she got plenty of offers, many from companies in Poland. Poland's ambassador to Britain, Arkady Zygotski, told me he's not surprised.
And the truth is that I really want to encourage Poles to consider coming back, because Poland needs Poles who has a lot of experience, who knows language.
Late last year, Zygotski wrote to all the Polish citizens living in Britain to advise them on their status after Brexit, and he asked them to think about going home.
There is very low unemployment and a lot of new opportunities. One of my dreams was that Poles could live and work abroad in the United Kingdom, but also can come back to fulfill their dreams.
Zygotski reckons the 100,000 or so Polish citizens have left Britain in the last couple of years. It's hard to tell, though, if that's all because of Brexit, the booming Polish economy, or just a hankering to return to the homeland. Barbara says she misses the British pub scene and the music festivals, but there's some things she doesn't miss, like the long working hours.
In the UK, it was very common to stay after hours, but here, it's very rarely that anybody would ever have to stay past, let's say, 5:30. At the very beginning, it was hard for me to adjust to all this free time. Also, I don't have to spend, let's say, half or 30% of my wage on rent.
Despite London rent prices, Anna Oppenheim plans to stay in the UK. She's left the fashion industry and now works as a campaign organiser for a group called Another Europe is Possible. It's an organisation working against Brexit. So I ask if, come midnight tomorrow, her job will effectively be over.
Well, we still believe that Another Europe is possible. And by this, we believe in a united, integrated Europe, a Europe that defends the climate, protects workers' rights, protects migrants. These are the values we still believe in. And whether we're in and out of the EU, we can be campaigning for them.
The Brexiteers will have their moment, though, with a late-night party planned in the centre of London. But for Anna, she's hoping for a politics-free weekend at home. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
In Brussels, the European Parliament has officially marked Brexit and bid goodbye to the UK as one of its member states. Emotions were high and speeches were many as members of the EU Parliament held their last debate and vote, and then agreed to the political divorce that we all know as Brexit. After the vote, MEPs marked the occasion by holding hands and breaking into song. Timing is everything, and this seems kind of awkward. Mike Pompeo flies to Ukraine today as the impeachment trial at the U.S. Senate continues, with Ukraine at the center of it all. The Secretary of State will meet with President Volodymyr Zelensky tomorrow. The word from Kiev is that Zelensky and his team are hoping their meeting with Pompeo gives only positive results. Let's bring in Evelyn Farkas to talk about this. She served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Ukraine, Russia, and Eurasia during the Obama administration. She's also running for Congress from New York State. What do you make of the timing of Pompeo's trip to Ukraine today, Evelyn, at the height of impeachment?
Yeah, well, I suspect this was probably in the works before, so he didn't know. Secretary Pompeo didn't know, first of all, that he could not have predicted that he would behave so impolitically towards an NPR reporter, which I suspect we'll get to later on the topic of Ukraine. But second, of course, coming in the middle of impeachment, it's quite odd. Again, probably this was on the books earlier, and it's coming, I would say, at an awkward time. I'm not really sure what he's trying to highlight by going there, except probably he'll talk about corruption, because this administration is trying to hide what the president did, which was ask for a bribe from the president of Ukraine, under the subterfuge that our president cares about corruption in Ukraine.
Pompeo actually had to postpone his trip to Kiev earlier this month. He was focusing his attention on Iraq. So you worked on Ukraine issues during Obama's administration. What do you make of the U.S.-Ukraine relationship right now?
I think it's troubled. Its foundation is still pretty good, I would argue, because the reality is that the support for Ukraine is solid. So the members of Congress on both sides of the aisle are solidly in support of Ukraine, even though they understand what's at stake, even though they're playing this game, which is dangerous to Ukraine because it's creating the impression that we're not behind Ukraine in a bipartisan fashion, if you follow. So there's a bit of a theater going on in Congress. Underlying that, I think the U.S. policy remains the same. This Secretary of State, again, now is straddling between the shadow foreign policy of President Trump and the actual foreign policy of our country, if you can follow that, as convoluted as it sounds.
Well, no, I do follow it. And that exchange you mentioned between Pompeo and that NPR reporter, my former colleague here at The World, Mary Louise Kelly, included his comment that Americans do not care about Ukraine, although he's walked those comments back since then.
Right.
Does he have a point?
Well, I think, first of all, there are about a million Americans of Ukrainian descent. Mm. So I think they care about Ukraine. But I think seeing the patriotic Americans testify on the Hill, you know, Fiona Hill, Masha Yovanovitch and others talk about why we're in Ukraine, why we're supporting Ukraine. It's about democracy. So I think Americans who are paying attention understand that we have to stand up to Vladimir Putin and the autocrats, and we have to stand up against the autocratic tendencies of this president. I mean, that's why I'm running for Congress. That has brought people like me to the point where we're getting political, because this is about democracy.
And Evelyn, you're credited with sounding the alarm on Russia's interference in the 2016 elections. What's changed for you since then? How do you make sense of what's going on in U.S. politics right now?
Right. So I rang the alarm. I was really one of the first to go on national television
right.
and say, this is wrong, and the American people and Congress need to wake up and pay attention. This campaign, the Trump campaign at the time, was obviously out in broad daylight encouraging the Russian government to interfere in our elections. Of course, we've learned since then it was worse. And even worse, as a sitting president, this president has encouraged Ukraine, tried to get Ukraine involved in interfering in our elections. Now, thankfully, the president of Ukraine wasn't buying it. You know, he didn't want to get involved, even though he, to my mind, the way I interpret it is that he pretended he would try to help President Trump because he didn't want to offend him. But in effect, he said no. The Ukrainian government did the correct thing, unlike the Russian government, which is continuing to tamper in our elections, even by trying to make Ukraine a pariah in the United States.
Right. I mean, so why is Russia doing this? I mean, is it to just keep Ukraine at bay and out of the EU, or to keep a Democrat out of office? I mean, what's the grand scheme?
Yes, Russia wants a weak America. Russia wants an America that will not stand up next to Ukraine and prevent Russia basically from politically annexing Ukraine. Russia's still killing Ukrainians in eastern Ukraine. There's a full-on, you know, war going on there. Maybe not full-on, it's lower-level conflict, but nevertheless, people are dying. the Russians are to blame. They are still occupying Crimea, which is illegal, and we aren't doing enough to stand up for our ally Ukraine. That's the problem. President Trump, instead of pointing to Ukraine and saying, oh no, they were corrupt and I was trying to help them, he should be standing up and saying, Russia, get out of Ukraine's backyard. Move your military forces out. Move your equipment out. Move your proxies out.
Evelyn Farkas served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Ukraine, Russia, and Eurasia during the Obama administration. Great to speak with you, Evelyn. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco. Take care.
Next time you pass a herd of cows, try listening closely. You might think this is silly, but in fact, for farmers, it could be pretty important. The World's Amanda McGowan explains.
If you spoke cow, you'd recognize what that meant. She's in heat. But if you don't speak cow, that's okay. That's what Alexandra Green is for. She's a PhD student at the University of Sydney in Australia, and her research focuses on how cows communicate.
What we found in this particular study is that their voices are individually distinct, and more importantly, that they can maintain these individual voice characteristics across contexts.
That's right. Cows have voices, and they talk to each other. Green figured this out by taking some recording equipment and hanging out with a herd of 13 heifers. She cataloged hundreds of their moos in a variety of situations. Getting food, being denied access to food, being ready to mate, etc. And as it turns out, you can tell a lot from a moo. That's the sound one heifer made after being denied food, just as she's expecting to chow down.
That particular call contains what we call non-linear parts, called deterministic chaos. And this is what makes the voice sound quite rough and angry. And this sort of just indicates her frustration over not receiving the feed. This is one of the features that also contributes to the individuality of her voice.
And just how frustrated is she? Well, you might relate.
Towards the end of that call, she inhales, and this is because she's vocalized so loudly with such energy that she just has to take a deep breath at the end.
So why would a cow need to communicate? After all, don't they just hang around eating grass all day? I mean, what is there to say? Well, as it turns out, cows are social creatures, and that means they care about each other. Here's Green again.
The fact that they have these vocal cues to individuality may assist them in recognizing their herd mates and attract help for them in times of need. And yeah, they vocalize over short and long distances as a form of communication.
I was curious about whether these observations gelled with the way farmers see their cows. So I called up Pete Stickney. He takes care of 40 cows at the Putney School in Vermont. The school has its own dairy farm. And Green's theory seemed to track with his experience.
Mooing usually indicates some sort of distress or change. Usually the change is from moving from one group to another, and they move back at their old compatriots.
In fact, dairy farmers might be the exact people this research helps the most, especially those with larger herds who might not get to spend as much one-on-one time with their cows. Green's research might give those farmers a template for understanding how their cows are feeling. Because you know what they say about happy cows.
The farming industry, what we're seeing, especially in the dairy industry, is that herd sizes are increasing and individual animal attention is decreasing. So we're needing to develop novel ways to assess welfare and well-being on farm, and it could greatly benefit their farming.
I asked Pete Stickney about this too, about seeing cows not as a herd, but as individuals.
You know, people are surprised that I know 40 cows apart, but people who have two or three or four dogs or cats certainly know them apart. You know, we make a living from our cows, so we're very well acquainted with their needs, you know, their wants.
So maybe the secret to happiness is just being heard. For The World, I'm Amanda McGowan.
Safe to say, the 2020 election will be one of the most consequential in our lifetimes. And on Monday, it starts with the Iowa caucuses. In our newsroom, we happen to have a native Iowan, reporter Rupa Shenoy. We sent her back to the state to help us understand Iowa's first-in-the-nation status.
The short answer to why Iowa goes first in the nation is that they thought of it. The longer answer takes you back to Vietnam. The war there in the 1960s had young people protesting passionately in the U.S. They battled the police outside the 1968 Democratic Convention. The violence was on live national television.
Hundreds of marchers and dozens of policemen were injured.
Restraint was absent on both sides.
Afterward, the Democratic Party decided it needed to be more inclusive. Democrats in Iowa thought the whole process of choosing a candidate would be calmer if it was slowed down and spaced out more. So in 1972, they pushed their own caucus super early to first in the nation. This is the then chair of Iowa Democrats, Tom Whitley, on PBS.
We organized a very, very significant kind of effort to convince first the candidates that they ought to be in Iowa because the national press was going to be here, and then to convince the national press that they should be in Iowa because the candidates were going to be here.
And it worked.
I started my own campaign 21 months ago. I didn't have any political organization, not much money, nobody knew who I was.
Jimmy Carter mounted an intensive county-by-county campaign in Iowa.
Former Georgia governor Jimmy Carter did extremely well with 27%.
He went from unknown underdog to Iowa caucus winner.
Hi, I'm Leo. Good to meet you.
Nice to meet you. I went to see the keeper of everything caucus-related for the Iowa government, Leo Landis, at the State History Museum.
You know, here's some of the 76 campaign buttons. Grits and Fritz, of course, was the slogan for Jimmy Carter once he selected Mondale as
Carter's
his
win
candidate.
Was what really made Iowa's role as first in the nation meaningful.
By 1980, the national candidates are saying, Iowa matters, and Iowa, I remember in 80, I was a eighth grader. In that caucus, and I remember neighbors talking about who they were going to caucus for on the Republican side.
As he's saying that, it occurs to me that in 1980, my parents and big sister had just arrived here in Iowa from India as part of the first major wave of non-white immigration to the U.S.
This is becoming important, just as, like, for example, my parents came in 1975. So just as the state was becoming more diverse.
I would say so, and that really is true.
Iowa's population of foreign-born residents doubled by 2000, while the state's stature grew as a place that carefully evaluated candidates.
They said this day would never come.
For many Iowans, their wisdom was proven when the son of a Kenyan, Barack Obama, won the Iowa caucus.
Thank you, Iowa!
And that's the first thing they point to now when critics like former Democratic presidential candidate Julian Castro argue that Iowa is still overwhelmingly white and doesn't represent the diversity of the country, and so shouldn't be first to choose presidential candidates.
A lot of momentum is created by what happens here in Iowa. So that means that when we do get to the most diverse states, after Iowa and New Hampshire, that those states actually have less people to choose from.
In response, even the chair of the Iowa Republican Party says,
"For crying out loud, we made Barack Obama in this state."
Jeff Kaufman is a seventh-generation Iowan.
It belies common sense to me, essentially implying that Iowa Democrats can't get past the color of one's skin after launching Barack Obama.
Kaufman says when Iowans chose Obama, they showed they aren't predictable. And he thinks it's important they stay that way. That's why Iowa Republicans raised more than $1 million to hold their own caucuses on Monday.
We are doing this for 2024, 2028, 2032, et cetera. Every 4 years, we have to show the country again why we deserve to be first in the nation.
Staying first in the nation is so important that even though he's state Republican chair, and even though Iowa went to Trump in the last presidential election, Kaufman refuses to say that Iowa is a red state because he wants it to stay that unpredictable first state in the nation.
We are purple. Now, we're a little bit deeper shade of purple, and I have every intention of trying to keep this state as red as it has been, especially in national politics. But look, we are a swing state. And what that means is that nobody is ever going to take us for granted. As long as we are not predictable, we're going to continue to be right in the eye of the storm.
And Kaufman says that means he'll be able to continue to look his grandchildren in the eye and tell them that in the United States, presidential candidates still have to come to a low-income, flyover state with a declining, aging population and appeal to every voter, giving every person of every background the chance to participate in the political process. That's the promise of the Iowa caucuses. In practice, it doesn't always work that way.
It's exciting. It's kind of traumatic.
For retired University of Iowa librarian Donna Hurst, caucusing can be really chaotic. People yell and barter with each other to gain support for their candidate. Some people really enjoy it. Donna compares it to a circus.
Where everybody is crammed in and there's all kinds of things going on. You're sitting in that dunk tank and somebody dumps you in the cold water.
And that's someone who's lived in Iowa for decades. Imagine someone who's new to the country, Hirst says. She's chair of a broad interfaith coalition in eastern Iowa, holding events to get diverse groups involved in the election process.
There's been discussion about whether or not we should encourage non-English speakers to attend the caucus because it might be a really negative experience and they may never vote again because of the caucus.
That's exactly the opposite of what Iowa Democrats say they want. The Iowa caucuses were originally created to make the process of choosing the Democratic presidential nominee more accessible. And this year they're rolling out a bunch of changes aimed at making the caucuses even more inclusive. One way they're doing that is by creating Spanish-speaking caucus sites and providing interpreters, although activists say there won't be enough to meet the demand. Another way Democrats are trying to increase participation is by allowing Iowans around the world who qualify and go through an online training to host satellite caucuses.
I mean, there's not too much to it, to be honest.
Josh Kucera is a writer hosting an Iowa satellite caucus in the Republic of Georgia.
I like having the chance to connect a little bit with Iowa. You know, I'm a proud Iowan.
Kucera says participating in the caucuses just feels like an Iowan thing to do. After nearly 50 years of being first in the nation, the caucuses are part of Iowa's identity. They seem to have made what Iowans think matter to the whole world. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy in Des Moines, Iowa.
So, Iowans' opinions matter, but does that include all Iowans? Tomorrow, Rupa reports on how the caucus process itself makes it difficult for immigrants and refugees to participate. That is our show today from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.